So I'm going to sort of do two things. I'm going to talk mainly about CH&M and how it's structured and how it's funded, all of that, where it's located administratively, how it's staffed, et cetera. And then I'm going to do what I said I thought we ought to do earlier in the day, which is to, I don't know, rather than just describing, to make a kind of recommendation for how I think things should look. Can move on to the next slide. First, I'll start with CH&M. Keep going. Sorry, that was just a cursor. I have my performative slides, and I'm not performing them. If you want to go to the next one, CH&M has been around for 15 plus years. We are part of the history department. I think in some ways that's fairly unique among digital humanities centers, where we are actually administratively a unit of the history department at George Mason. We're you know, an arm of the history department that's sort of about as large as the body of the department. We started out very small in 1994, and we're pretty small for about 6-7 years or so. And so when I came on in 2002, I think I was like the fifth or sixth employee. And so, you know, sort of been small and sort of been a small center. And then since then, we've gotten big. We've got now 20-plus active projects in three, what we call very brand new divisions, a division of education, a division of public projects, a division of research. Education builds, we define those basically along the lines of audiences. Education builds things for resources, tools, and other things for students and teachers, mainly high school students and teachers, but really K-12. Public projects builds things, tries to serve audiences that look more like maybe museum audiences, sort of the interested general public. And then research does things that serve primarily scholarly audiences. In each of those cases, the audiences are almost entirely, and the audiences we serve are almost entirely external to the university. So we're not doing things for GMU faculty or students by and large. I mean, plenty of GMU students and faculty use our tools and our resources, but they're not designed specifically for them. They're designed for mainly external audiences. We've got 50 plus or minus employees, we've just been sort of redoing our org chart for a number of reasons, but essentially those employees fall into, let's say, three categories, kind of in terms of hierarchical categories. One is we have the level of what we call the directors, and there are six of us, all with history PhDs, we're the ones who sort of serve as PIs on grants and stuff. Then there's the level of what we call the senior staff, and that includes another four or five people who are also in that kind of PI capacity. They're very active project managers. They're kind of leaders of the organization. It includes our office manager, our sysadmin and webmaster, some people who are newly credentialed PhDs or on their way to becoming history PhDs. So sort of the senior leadership of the organization is all kind of trained historians. And then we have a staff. I'm using these terms imprecisely, but a staff of people who do things from content development to programming, to design, to project management, etc. To pay for them is, it's roughly $3 million a year. 90% of that, plus or minus, depending on the year, is grant funded. So we are almost entirely grant-funded. So that means soft money. And that's how we've really always been. We didn't really start out with any hard money to speak of. You know, we had some faculty who were given some time to do this. We had a couple of grad students at the beginning who sort of part-time, occasional grad students. But really, the since the beginning, even before the center was founded, it was really driven by bringing in grant money. And so, you know, it's sort of, in some respects, although, you know, a lot of what we do looks a lot of like what Bethany does, it's kind of probably the opposite proportion of how it's funded. And so I think that sort of shows the diversity of kind of funding models and things for these. And I think that has a huge impact on the way positions are defined and filled and the kind of status that they're given and what they're allowed to, you know, what people are allowed to do. I mean, we can't really give people 20% time. I mean, you know, we sort of do informally. We encourage people to work on their own research, and a lot of the new projects at CH&M bubble up from the staff, from the staff level, from programmers and other people. But because they're paid by grants, you know, you can't like tell NEH, well, we're going to give these people, you know, Jason, we want you to pay for 20% of their time to kind of do whatever they feel like. No, they got to work on the NEH grant. So I think it does. I think one of the things I think we should really be very cognizant of in all of this is so much of this depends on where the money's coming from. I mean, all of this depends on where the money's coming from. And, you know, so we can talk about ideals, but, you know, when it comes down to dollars, they can only be used in certain ways, and we try to use them to best effect. So I think that if you want to just go to the next slide, I think in some respects CH&M is a good model. In some respects, it's not such a good model. In one respect, I think it's a good model because you know, we're big, we've been successful, we've got lots of different kinds of people working in lots of different kinds of jobs who are funded in kind of creative ways. We've been small, we've gotten big. You know, for those reasons, I think it's a good model. For other reasons, I think it's, you know, maybe not a good model because, I mean, while, you know, in some ways it's a source of strength for us to be 90% grant funded, keeps us on our toes, keeps us innovative, allows us a certain amount of flexibility. You know, in many respects, it's our money, and we can do what we want to with it. When that is challenged, we can always sort of say, well, you know, we could stop bringing in money if you'd like. So, you know, I think there's some strength in that. At the same time, I think I would rather be in Bethany's situation where it was 90% hard money and 10% soft money. So you know, I think your mileage will vary with looking at CH&M as a model. But one thing I do think comes out of it, and it's this, and this is something that I think I'd like to us to stress, is that I think for in a lot of different ways that tenure is not the answer for the digital humanities. I think in some very practical ways it's not the answer for the digital humanities, and that like the number of tenure track positions is not growing, it's shrinking. And I think, you know, we're fighting in many respects a losing battle if we want to try to staff our centers with tenure type positions. I think tenure track types of jobs also don't necessarily map well onto the work, always map well onto all the kinds of things that digital humanity centers need to do. But I think in the bigger sense in that I mean that tenure is not the answer is that I think that the model of the tenure track, and I think John sort of said it best with the runway, where there is a job that you come into at age 30 or age 35, and that there's a clear path to being, you know, emeritus at 80. No, I mean, but that, right? That's like what I think we all sort of have in the back. That's our bias, right? As academics, we have that bias coming into these discussions that's what a good job looks like, right? A good job looks like you know, assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, emeritus. You know, and that's what a career looks like. And I think that's like not a that's not a productive model for discussions like these. I think there are always going to be those kinds of positions, and I think there need to be those kinds of positions in digital humanities, and I think there's some real value to having them. But for the vast majority of people working in digital humanities, they are not going to have those kinds of jobs. And so I think psychologically we need to get around, you know, to sort of accepting that and to valuing that. And, you know, it's sort of a psychological shift. And we all need to think that, like, a good job doesn't mean a tenure-track job. There can be other kinds of good jobs. We should strive. So instead of striving for, you know, career positions within the university, what we should strive for is like fair, just, equitable employment models that offer people strong career identities, interesting work, and then future opportunities, whether they're at our own institutions or elsewhere. So I think what I think with all of this is we should, you know, like drop that mental model of the tenure track position as being the best kind of job. I think for digital humanities, that's not necessarily the case.